All right. Well, I was looking at some of your pictures recently, and I've seen other people having this, and they have often there's a cast iron skillet, and they have this perfectly fried egg that's like crispy on the outside, and it's like that European orange in the middle. And so my question to you is, how do you fry an egg like that?
Look, I worked hard on this. I've made to give I've looked through a lot of error over the years, I think. But yeah, it ends up being an egg.
And like, is there just like a lot of
Liquid
oil that
cooking.
you cook it in? How do you do that? I mean, like, how many minutes is it? How's it work out?
Well, the creepy thing is, I don't actually eat eggs. So I have never I've never eaten my own product. So I just try to people and they have to deal with it. And yeah, it's a huge amount of oil. Yeah, it's a huge
A
amount of
huge
oil,
amount.
and it's done relatively quickly. But I don't know, it might taste horrible, but people are too polite to tell me there's.
One, when I was coming up, I learned that you never get high in your own supply. So you've accomplished that. That's good. And then so the other thing I learned is that if you want to cook an omelet, the secret to an omelet is a really hot pan. And does that apply to like a sunny side up fried egg?
I think it does. I have a question about the omelet because my dad keeps going on about he wants an omelet pan, and whatever I supply him with, he is just disappointed. He has this thing in his head that there's a special pan for omelets, and I wonder if it's a Japanese thing, like a square pan or something like this.
Like
But
that goes
anything
with the
I
square
show him, so
watermelons.
yeah, exactly, or like a little kind of shovel thing. So if I don't know where I'm going wrong with this omelet pan, but I've disappointed my father in so many ways.
Here you thought you could finally catch up to making your dad fully proud of you with something as simple as an omelet
No,
pan. And once
no.
again, you
Even in this,
fall flatter than an
once
omelet.
again.
Well, when I'm out about in my corporate world, there often is, and in hotels, conferences, someone will have a setup where they've got one of those little tabletop stovetops. If you're lucky, it's connected to like some, I'm sure it's not butane, I don't know, kerosene, whatever, some portable gas. Like, I remember I went to an internal conference for a, let's say, an international trucking company that made and sold trucks. And they had some people set up and they would cook omelets for you. They had just like a nice long card table. I guess that's not a card table. And they would make omelets for you. And and then they have a pan that's like, I'm holding my hands up as if you can see, but maybe about as wide as my head up and down. And they seem to cook in that. And they just like spray a shit ton of oil in it and then put your omelet in there. I don't know. And it's got that, do you have the non-stick pans over there?
Yes.
I mean, who knows if that's NAFTA approved?
Yeah, the key to so many of these things seems to be lots of oil, lots of butter, and just go for it. I can't believe you're not using more butter. That's it.
Well,
That's the key.
maybe that's the thing, is I don't actually use a lot of butter. I was raised to think that butter was like, came out of the devil's teat or something. But I think butter's okay.
Yeah, the devil. Yeah.
I think it's good. So
Yeah,
maybe now,
something's got to be okay.
would you say maybe like a half tablespoon, or I don't know how you would measure it, but like a half, I don't know, the top of your thumb's like size of butter. How much would you put in?
Yeah. As you would say, half a cup.
Whoa, half a
Isn't
cup.
that what you do? Oh yeah. Straight in.
I think
Straight in there.
then you would have what do you call it? It's not poached, is it? You would have
A culinary.
a poached egg, poaching it in butter. That'd be
A
wonderful.
poached egg. Poached egg.
Like, can you
Yes.
imagine a pot full
Let's
of
try and
boiling
do.
melted butter and you drop a few eggs in there to cook? What would that even be like?
Easy.
Okay, so then
Terrifying.
I'm gonna experiment. Okay, wait, I've got two more questions and then we'll get on to our topics here. The first one is, I saw you had it in a cast iron skillet, and is the magnitude of butter you're using, does that prevent the cast iron skillet from getting like egg burned onto it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I never I it took me a long time to realize the older I get, the simpler my realizations are. Like when I was younger, I realized things which are complicated. And now as I get older, the only things I realize are really simple. So cast iron pans, turns out they're a really good idea. And it took me 4 to 5 years to work this out. So later on in life, I look forward to discovering running water, fire, taps work, all that kind of stuff.
There's always a revolution in the understanding of toilet paper. That I think maybe that's towards the end.
Oh, yes, yes.
I don't really know it. I'm not old
sans
enough.
Teeth.
Sans teeth. That's right.
I'm not old enough.
So then my last question, my last question on this topic is, so what seasoning do you put on top of this egg? And when do you put it on? Is it after, during, before? And what is it?
I don't trust anybody with the cruet, as we say over here. And I don't hold with this idea that people should be allowed to put their own salt and pepper on things. I feel I should decide. So usually it's more pepper than people want and less salt than they want. And that is it.
I
cover all the bases there, really. Yeah.
It's the theory of chef has put sufficient salt on here, so there is none on the table.
Oh, completely. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Your vegetarian, non-egg eating chef has decided this is what you're going to eat. Yeah.
That's right.
I honestly had thought of branching out into fish because I saw some guy in New Orleans cooking Cajun fried amount of butter. I mean, it was just a ridiculous amount of butter, and I thought I might try that out. Obviously not on here. We are again. Oh, your quality's gone up.
The internet was faring poorly. I wonder if that's my problem.
Yes.
You know, now I have to edit
internet
some again.
Weather.
It's terrible. All right, I got this whole new brand new Wi-Fi, and I don't know if it's working.
Yeah,
we'll see. It has the Disney Circle application for like regulating what my kids look at. Do you truck with that kind of thing?
Need
to control what the kids see.
We don't have people have tried that kind of stuff over here, but it's never really gone down very well. It doesn't seem to be that popular. I think what we prefer to do is the traditional English method of pretending nothing's happening and fudging it and just allowing the ISPs to, so that you obviously you pay your local ISP. There are a few providers over here and, you know, you go to certain websites and they just start dropping off and you think, well, I don't remember an announcement about this. So if I go to like really weird adult content websites, like, I don't know, archive.org, it'll just say, oh no, this is adult content. So, okay, that's adult content now, and various VPNs and that sort of stuff. They've all slowly gone. That is strange. That seems really strange.
Yeah,
it's a voluntary close quotes.
We started using this, and I restricted my son and my daughter's video to 30 minutes a day in the little overlord controls. And we got home.
Whoa!
We got home, and my son was like, "It says the Wi-Fi is working, but the video is not playing." And then it took me a while to realize what was
happening.
Explain,
father.
That's right. And I was like, oh, I don't know. You know, sometimes services don't work. And he was like, what? What do you mean? Like, well, you know, sometimes, you know, like Netflix doesn't work sometimes. And then he bought it.
For the next 23 and a half hours.
That's right. He bought it. And then later on, I was working and I looked down and he was like playing with some clay. And I was like, man, it worked. So we'll see if we can change that. But that is.
It sends you back to the Stone Age.
Exactly. Yeah. But I have very conflicting feelings about like this because, you know, I was like, I'm like of this generation of people that was basically, you know, partially raised by a TV. And like, I turned out fine. I'm a pillar of society.
Yeah,
for Christ's sake.
You totally are.
That's right.
Yeah, you very much are. Yeah. Yeah. I was brought up on no TV and I'm quite unwell now. So that does prove something, I think.
Oh, yes. Well, that's a good pair that we make. We cancel out both sides, which means I don't know what that means. All TV, halfway, no TV, some TV. We'll see. I don't think they even call it TV anymore.
Well, exactly. Let's not go down this rabbit hole because it's been covered by experts. But I did have a question. When you mentioned Google Photos, photo sharing, all that kind of stuff, I thought people have asked me about why using Google Photos. And for me, the only answer is it's the least worst option. It's very bad, but it's still the least worst option.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, but there's so much on, you know, what used to be called the internet, which is just very bad, but everything else is worse. So, you know, I revel in Google Photos.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty good assessment.
Yeah. A ringing endorsement. It's really bad.
Yeah.
But everything else is worse.
Well, you know, I think what's interesting about...
I mean, I think...
Go on.
I think the reason those things are getting, kind of falling apart is because attention has simply moved elsewhere.
Mm.
I don't think they have got worse. It's just that they haven't improved. And, you know, the reason that people aren't working on Apple photo sharing or Google Photos is that there aren't enough customers for it. It's just old people.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It is sort of a, it's frustrating, right? Cause there was an error where this Flickr thing was great and it was wonderful. And then, but then in my experience, no one used it except nerds. So that was frustrating. And then there was this part where Flickr wasn't cool because it wasn't doing the service of backing up your photos. And so that was annoying. But then they added that in.
Yes.
But then they never really followed through on the whole like managing your own photos thing, which I think is the direction that, so from that basis, how do I manage my own photos is where like Apple comes from. And they're sort of like the baseline. And then Adobe's somewhere way back there, but I don't think anyone cares about that anymore. And then Google. So then you had Apple iCloud Photos something, which is just like, I don't want to get into a ranty hole about it. It's just astounding what a failure that is from that company. And then you have Google Photos, which I use that and as you do yourself. And I feel like it's exactly what you're saying. It's like at this point, all I want is more or less reliable, automatic backing up of my photos somewhere and the ability to browse them and trust that it works. And that's what Google Photos does basically. And it's also free, which is nice, but I'd be happy to pay for it. But it even has some editing features and it seems to work okay. But yeah, it really is frustrating that just like the Apple Photos thing doesn't work. And then finally, the thing that they also did is I think they used to have that Picasso app. And if I remember, it was pretty cool. Like it is nice to have a desktop experience, but they just tanked that. And now it's just all on the internet. Maybe if I was in the Android ecosystem,
Well, there was Picasso Web. There was that web view of it.
Mm.
But on iOS, you can in Google Photos, you can send it to Snapseed, which is I think a Google product as well. But it's all a bit. It's I mean. The thing that's been said to me is, Robert, if you were used to using Flickr, why not just go over to Instagram? But it's not a like for like replacement.
No,
but the market has moved such that that's what people want, and that's what people sell. At least it doesn't matter whether people want it, but whether people sell it.
Yeah,
but I mean, all of them seem to be. Fracturing now. I mean, we've gone past the stage where wouldn't it be great if Tumblr just charged me $5 a month or Instagram charged me $5 a month? And I still have that rather old fashioned attitude of, please, can you charge me $5 a month and then we'll all call it quits? It'll all be fine somehow. Mm-hmm. All those weird ads on Instagram and Tumblr will go away. But the reason why they don't do that is presumably. It wouldn't work. Otherwise, they would have done it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is worth contemplating that maybe you're worth more than $5. Maybe that's the point, and you wouldn't pay. I mean, part of the point.
Yeah. But that would be an interesting number to see. for, you know, someone like Tumblr to show back to me, you do realize if you wanted to own this experience for yourself, it would be $95 this month. That's how much we've made from selling your information out to advertisers. I think, whoa, this is a good deal.
That's what y'all need to put in that GDPR thing, is like you have to report back how much you're worth to each
yes.
service.
Yeah, because I mean, there's bits, especially in Germany, of I saw a thing someone posted recently where he'd basically gone through in Germany all the public organizations he could ask for information from. But that's an interesting idea, that you could ask for how much money have you made out of this information, not just what information you hold on me.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe later.
And, you know, it might just be another source of depression. Like, I'm only worth $2 to Instagram. I need to up my game.
but then it would be a good deal for yourself, wouldn't it? It'd be like, oh, $2. Yeah, I can afford that. But then you'd have to start advertising yourself and, you know, putting your own ads in to kind of boost yourself, or make yourself look terrible and then get a really good deal.
Yeah. You know, this is reminding
me. I have.
This is reminding me. I was thinking last week at some point that, you know, there's a whole thing about how the tech companies are destroying civilization, as I like to think of it, or the Web 2.0 yeah. companies. Yeah. And I was thinking there was this time where this idea of gamification was an exciting new thing that, like, maybe the Tim O'Reillys of the world would get up there and talk about it as if it was going to solve, like, you know, it was going to introduce a Stuart Brand utopia if we just had gamification. And then I was realizing that basically, just like so many things, gamification was taken and turned into a way to make you worth lots of money to advertisers. So like all those lessons were like appropriated to all the stuff we have nowadays. So you keep involved with things. And it was, I actually didn't think about it at the time, but I guess maybe like the health apps use gamification or something, which just seems like totally crap. Like, I don't need some little like image from Apple to encourage me. Well, let me rephrase that. I don't think an image from Apple. Well, let me rephrase that. I have run the experiments extensively that people sending me images in no way encourages me to be healthy. So like, I don't know. Maybe that helps some people.
Well, I think it's interesting that in that thing in particular, in that I know a lot of people who have Apple watches and Apple devices, and zero times has anyone shown me, hey, check this out, I've got this new triangular icon that spins around in my health app or whatever it is.
Right.
So that's how, I mean, it's basically, it's the new ping. It's just like Apple are putting it out there and it's just died. I mean, no one cares, because it was, to me, looking at the, is it the health app or activity, whatever.
Yeah, there you go, the rings.
And these little icons would pop up. Yeah. And I had to work out what I was looking at. It's like, what is this? I don't even know what this is. You know, congratulations, 20 over the root of pi or whatever. What is this? Congratulations on your longest streak, 2 days. Great, okay. And some of that was just embarrassing. So no, that didn't go anywhere, really.
It's a little bit like the photos thing, where I think it's fun to like look at this software and reverse engineer the lifestyles that people assumed people were living if they were to use their software that way.
Yes. Hey, check this out. Who says that? No one's going to use that.
That's right.
That's what sort of person? But the thing now, I was trying to separate in my mind the original idea of gamification and now, you know, stars, or what does Medium have? Claps. Claps?
Yeah.
Oh, God, it does not sound good. And I can read something and get to the bottom and it has like 3 claps, which to me feels like, so should I not have bothered reading this? And then, you know, there's a DHH thing, which is like 30,000 claps. And then I think, well, is this so popular that I shouldn't have read it? I mean, what is the, maybe they should put the number of claps at the top. So the optimum number of claps for a bit obscure but also quite interesting would be, I don't know, 60. But once it goes beyond that, it's like, I'm not linking to this because everyone's read it. Or this is too obscure. No one's going to hear about this at all. But the feedback now, that, I mean, that's not gamification, but it's, I don't know, retweets, likes. Once numbers get into the thousands, it becomes very quickly meaningless. And, you know, you've got a devalued currency. But still, they plod on with this stuff, such that you can read, you know, some Medium piece, and down at the bottom, 60,000 claps. What do I do with this? You know, do I congratulate myself on getting this far? Do I add a clap? I mean, why? What's the point? Is the person gonna look and say, oh, fantastic, one more clap? And what's beyond claps? I mean, what?
That feels like some kind of conceptual video art where it would just be like, it would be like a zoomed in screenshot of the clap section, and like a little cursor moves up and it has like 60,000 claps and it adds one, and then it's like 60,001.
Yeah.
And the viewer, of course, is left to interpret however they like, but perhaps the original intention was, you know, how little your contribution actually means or how much it means. Who knows? But put your claps in context.
Yeah. Who knows? But there'll be something after that. I mean, we are facing a claps collapse at some stage, where the whole clap market will just fold. All the value that we've invested in claps will disappear, and something else will have to be provided. I mean, it is a strange idea that the content of the writing needs to be supported by those extra pixels at the bottom. I think, why? I mean, do these writers, these good writers on Medium, need that? I don't think they do. But well, yeah, and something else will have to come on after that. God knows what.
Yeah. It is nice to have feedback, but no, the situation you outline is an absurd situation. And another, I mean, of course, as we used to say, you know, you've got all those power law effects, which are annoying in the sense of, I guess that's a challenge.
Well, if you're not making money out of them.
Yeah, that's right. I guess that's a challenge that a lot of content things have after a while is, how do you like surface new things that are equally interesting or find them? And then if you get stuck in just like, as you say, the Rails person, like, of course, everything they write is going to have a lot of claps. Like, it's the old, as our fearless leader says, right? Like, you know, I'm sure DHH could just delete the Rails GitHub repository and everyone would applaud him, right? Like, it's just, you just sort of get, you get finally. Claps by a bag full of claps. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, so here's
a clack of claps.
So related. Now, a long time ago, you used something called was it Tinderbox or Tinder? Or am I thinking of a dating site? I forget.
You're thinking of a dating site. I'm thinking of a highly advanced hypertext tool.
And then you've got this other thing I ran across recently called DevonThink, which you just look at the way that they do their name and you're like, oh, this thing's going to be a piece of work. Because like Devon is all capitalized and Think is all lowercased. And you know, at one point, I don't know if you've ever used this, but at one point I thought like, I write a lot. I should use this thing called Scrivener or whatever. And like, I don't first.
Oh,
And then, you know, I've gone back and forth.
Go on.
I've gone back and forth between using like, I've used Evernote since 2008. And I've also tried to use like Ulysses and Bear. I try to do the whole like, you know, Merlin Man tool chain of file naming and stuff like that. And then I always just go back to Evernote. Like it's always there, just waiting for me to return. But I frequently look at these. I haven't looked at Tinderbox in a while, but I was looking at DevonThink and I was like, oh, that looks so close to like this organized mess mentality of information. And maybe I should pay like $5,000 for it. I mean, it's not $5,000, but they are definitely not fueling themselves on claps. They get some money. And I don't know. So what are all those things? How do you think about all of that stuff?
All of this stuff those three examples in particular, DevonThink, Tinderbox, and Scrivener, are, in my head, all of a particular sort, and they actually are called artisanal software. And it's things which are desktop first, usually Mac first, and you can see the dotted line where a lot of those things have added on the actual rest of the web. So they are primarily applications which are you are using on your laptop or on your big iMac to make things on that screen. You're not updating websites or anything like that. You can update websites, particularly obviously Tinderbox, but they are quite personal. And they also have a kind of interesting development cycle where, as you've described, they kind of go quiet for years. And you think, I mean, have they gone bust? And then I think Tinderbox is a very good example of this. The recent sort of resurgence in Tinderbox has been absolutely huge. And the big leaps in version features have been really impressive. I mean, it's a huge amount of work that's been put into it. And each one of those things are built by either a single person or a very small team. And so they do look very particular. I mean, you're never going to look at a Tinderbox screen and imagine it's something else. It looks very, very Tinderbox. And DevonThink looks very, very DevonThink. But they also allow, strangely, for really wide interpretations of how to use them. I mean, I used to look at Tinderbox and think, one of the problems was, I don't know where to start because there is everything here. And you can do so much in that thing now. And DevonThink is similar, the arrangement of records and school. And I'm glad it's there. I know people are using it and swear. Yes, there is. There is version. They are easy pieces of the software and completely other end of the spectrum. Download an app on iOS and off you go. And things like DevonThink and Tinderbox have been around for a long, long time. So however weird they look, I often have the feeling of, you know, Mark Bernstein of Tinderbox, he's just going to go on and on and on. He's going to die with a keyboard in his hands. And the amount of work he's put into that really shows. I mean, they are absolute powerhouses of applications. Pretty small audience. They actually cost some money. But are they worth it? Yes, if you're going to use tools like that, they really are worth it. But yeah, they're out on their own. The only thing kind of a bit like it may be BB Edit. I mean, still has that kind of old school look. But yeah, I'm always dreading them going away, really. And I use Scrivener a bit. I use Tinderbox more, and I use DevonThink quite a lot as well. DevonThink's amazing, and each one of those, I use at most a quarter of their capabilities, more like a fifth.
Yeah, you know, it seems like as you go over that, like the way I would summarize my reaction to it, it's almost like a personal intranet that you're sort of setting up, which man, it's overwhelming. Yeah. And especially like, I haven't looked at Tinderbox in a long time, but like what you just like put everything in there and arrange it in some order and then it spits out an EPUB, or no, that's Scrivener. Like it just, there's this, every time I look at one of these tools, there's like a, you know, it goes back to what I was saying, like you reverse engineer the developer's worldview based on their software. And I don't know if I do this or not, but I feel like the basis of a lot of these is I have a bunch of small bits of information and I want them to almost kind of like self-organize with my nudging into a final form of something. And like, that's, I think that's kind of like what the Scrivener thing, right? Is if we were to do the physical manifestation of this in the real world, you would have a room covered with a bunch of little scraps of paper and thing. And then eventually, like in some sort of Kerouacian style, you're going to tape them all together into a novel, right? And like, it seems like that's the basis of a lot of this stuff is like, I just need a place to put all my shit. And then I'm going to like drag it around to be in the right shape or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Scrivener is very good at that. Tinderbox is almost too good at that. I mean, it's Tinderbox is a very open environment. But the what you said about modeling how the developer was thinking about this, the reason that I moved away from Tinderbox many years ago was basically the internet. And the reason I'm moving back to things like Tinderbox, including Tinderbox, is how the internet has changed to how it is now. So as you described it, a personal intranet years ago to me felt like, well, why on earth would I need that? And now I'm thinking I'm retreating from the web and leaving the web for the machines. And something like Tinderbox, even Tinderbox, is an information collator and browser and aggregator. So Tinderbox becomes the client and the web becomes the source that I'm pulling the information from. So it's not really bookmarks, it's the actual stuff itself. So often I use the Apple Safari reader view. Now you can look at a web page and just put it into reader view, that kind of simplified stuff, and just save it out as plain text or plain text with links or something like that into something like DevonThink or Tinderbox or something like that, and then do the actual reading offline, which almost reminds me of what was that Palm Pilot thing? Avant Go? Was it Avant Go or something like that? Where you could that was amazing.
Well, you know, nowadays you got an Insta paper or a Pocket or a Readability or something like that, isn't really oriented around like saving it for your future use and organizing it into your stream of stuff.
I think things like Instapaper and Pinboard, pinboard.in, are symptoms of the failure of the general web. The fact that people have to use those almost as a first point of call rather than, you know, a fallback. Mercury is a good example of that, Fog Creek people did Mercury.
The Trello kind of, thing? Oh, I don't know what that is.
Page renderer stuff.
Oh, right.
Yeah. The kind of page cleanup stuff. And the fact that those things not only exist, but are now built into browsers, I think, God, we're treating the wider intranet as a hostile environment. And people are overtly, you know, the Brave browser, those sorts of things. How on earth have we got into this situation where we're actually having to arm ourselves in order to browse the web? I mean, that's bad.
Yeah. So then tell me tell me an example of something that you would do in like both Tinderbox and DevonThink and like what the flow would be like. I mean, I don't even know what an appropriate example would be. Maybe this is it, is like how to properly fry an egg. Like that seems like a good topic, and I don't know what the destination is, but I know what all of, as we started off talking, I know what all the material is. You've got like five pictures of an egg that, you know, while you're cooking it, and you might have some ideas about like how much butter to put in, and then you might also have like, you know, what kind of pan you need. You got all this and maybe some research, and eventually, like, I guess you're going to want to like have a paper that gets printed on some little printer or something. I mean, I don't even know what the output is, but like, is that like something you would use these for?
I think the key term there is output. So if you open up Word, you open it up with the intent that, you know, you're going to create a Word document, and obviously, you know, Google Docs or something like that. You know what you're aiming for. I think one of the interesting effects of something like DevonThink, and more so Tinderbox, is that you are not necessarily sitting down at a document template and typing stuff in and pressing print or save at the end. They are, I think, what used to be called tools for thinking. DevonThink less so, Tinderbox very much more so. So people can kind of have a Tinderbox document, or a Tinderbox screen, as it were, with 40 little snippets in, which could grow to, say, 80 or 120. And it's you don't look at it and think, right, I have now finished my thing. You go back to it and you curate your own little view of the stuff that you're looking at. And you can do that intelligent agent stuff of show me all the stuff I've written in the past 3 days, or show me all the stuff I've written which has, more than 200 words in each note or something like that. With Devon Think, for me, it feels more like collating and building a concordance out of things that already exist. So loads of PDFs, snippets from the web, bookmarks, all that kind of stuff. And it's really good at saying, here are, most frequently occurring terms, that sort of stuff. And Devon Think is nice. I mean, it's a nice, not too complex interface. And it feels really nice and solid. Tinderbox feels more experimental, even though it's actually quite old software. It's quite mature software. And it's recently undergone quite a big kind of upgrade. So it still has that old school feeling of, pre-web, but you can also do stuff in it which brings you very, very close to a web-like experience, but on your own desktop. Mm. But that's, you can understand why this isn't particularly popular. I mean, it's no Instagram. Mm. So if you were thinking of, say, not exactly cooking an egg, but writing a book about cooking and with particular recipes in it, you would imagine using something like Tinderbox for building up all those little snippets and using something like Devon Think to pull in all of the information. But again, these are very much personal first, desktop first, and output to the web later if you really wanted to. But it's a niche area. Tools for Thinking is a niche area. And, as you've seen, if your goal is to think and the first thing you do is open up Word, you've built in a problem.
I like that. So that's the whole premise. As you were talking, I was clicking around and listening. Don't worry. But there is also a third edition of a book called The Tinderbox Way, which you can purchase for $35, which I love. Yes. This software that's like, before you buy the software, you need to read this, 29 chapter book on how the software thinks, which...
The least charitable way of describing that book is idiosyncratic.
Mm.
The guy who wrote the book, Mark Bernstein, who I've met on a couple of occasions, and I've been to their kind of mini conference in London. Genius is an overused word, but he is building and continues to build software which is very particular. And it's one of those things. You remember that who said that thing about, it was Seth Godin, of you just need 1,000 fans. After that, everything's easy. All you need is your first 1,000 fans. And Tinderbox may only have 1,000 fans, but that's all it needs. I mean, it will go on forever. It's a bit like BB Edit, I think.
Mm. And so as you're going over that, so let me correct my scenario, which I think kind of answers the question, is like, the goal is not to output something, although, as always, that's there if you want it. It's just sort of like a side effect. It's sort of like the goal of cooking food is not to generate compost, but that is something that happens if you're into it.
Yeah.
And instead, like you used a fun word there, there's like a concordance. So it's like you collect all this stuff as if it's like your personal library of some sort of like Renaissance lord or occasionally lady. And furthermore, it reminds me, I haven't read Montaigne in a long time, but it's sort of like you read all the old Renaissance stuff like Montaigne, and obviously they're writing for someone else because the thing was published and so forth and so on. But you get the feeling they were just like, they're living their charmed life and they're like, what I want to figure out is death. And so I'm going to write about that. And I'm going to like collect all these notes and all these things that I think about. And then I'm going to write down what I think about. I mean, this is almost like a better analogy to kind of go far afield as like your old Marcus Aurelius there, where you get the sense he's just like, I got this book that I carry around and it's got, whenever I'm down and I just want to like run off and destroy the Roman Empire, I feel like I should go slaughter some Gauls to feel better, I'll read this book and things will be fine.
Yeah.
And similarly, you could say, I want to know how to fry an egg. And so there's a part of my little Tinderbox Devon Think world called like eggs. And I've collected together all the information about frying eggs over here. And I've got this little audio clip from when I talked to someone and some experiments that I ran one time. And here's some cookbook stuff. And one time I was in Italy and found this old cookbook from the 1800s about fried eggs. So I took a picture of it and put it in here. And then God knows what. And then I can fry an egg. But it's more of, as you say, sort of like organizing information for yourself.
Yes, yes. And it's also, you reminded me, what you said reminded me of a couple of things, which is something like Tinderbox and including Tinderbox now in 2018 performs the task that I originally had performed for me by the internet. And I don't anymore. That idea of relatively small, relatively easy to consume bits of information that I could click on and link from and to and understand what I was looking at.
Mm.
And that the web for me now is presents much less of that, in that, you know, a lot of the time each URL I visit is a new kind of crazy interface that I have to learn. I'm too old for that.
Mm-hmm.
And having also, you can imagine a system, and I don't mean just in Tinderbox, but a system including Tinderbox where you are looking at a relative information and you don't have to see all the information as the same type. I mean, if you're looking at a Word document or slides, they are peers. You know, there's not one big slide which is the best slide. They're all slides. But in something like Tinderbox, you can have little notes and little snippets which are bigger or smaller or stuff you've just put to one side. It doesn't all have to be prized the same and put in and fixed in a template.
Mm.
So you can, it is like looking at side notes or scribbles in the margin that you can just have hanging around and you can bring them in and look at them again as you described and then discard them or just shuffle them to the side of the page. You know, like John Syracuse's thing about the spatial finder. You know, his bemoaning the loss of spatial finder, in that most humans are quite good at, I put this thing over there. And for goodness sake, computers do have screens. There is a concept which is over there. You know, it's the top left and blue. That's my little thing I've written over there. And increasingly that's going away. Or it's not going away. It's being replaced by something that's obviously more popular for people under 45.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you're alluding to like there's the cause being to go back is like nowadays everyone wants to just get more claps, both on the publishing side, but also on the producing stuff side, right? Like the motivation is to make attention grabbing things. And so a lot of the thinking goes into that. And it does like, I don't know, you got your old, Medium is the message thing where like the stuff you produce ends up fitting into a clap driven culture instead of being the careful curation of things, not to be all alliteration crazy, like I'm having a stroke or something, but yeah. It is like collecting information like that. I guess it happens in a business context, but I don't know. I don't think I've ever firsthand seen in a work context, people successfully using software to collaborate to like the full potential of the thing, like beyond a spreadsheet. That works really well for what it does. But like, I've never witnessed anyone like using these or a mind map or even like marginally using a shared Dropbox folder successfully.
Yeah. Yeah. And this honestly, it really surprises me, and it shouldn't, but it does in a way. Maybe it should surprise me. But things like I've seen relatively kind of sensible uses of things like Google Docs. But to think not much. And, you know, my rather kind of, again, one of my naive dreams was, you know, in a meeting, in what used to be called a meeting, say 8 people around a table, a projector up with a shared document and people banging away at the shared document. But I very rarely see it. And yet we're sitting in front of the technology to do exactly that. It seems weird that it just seems to pass people by. I remember one of my favorite things was a thing in an early version of Userland Frontier, Dave Weiner's thing, which is I think he called it shared outlines, which was very, very basic. It was like an outline which you just type stuff into. So it's like a plain text shared document which had outlines. And seeing it work was just amazing. Again, it just hasn't taken off. We're still in that situation where quite often we're looking at one person standing up, giving a presentation, and I don't know, most of the room either tuning out or deleting their email or something like that. Whereas these tools are actually available. It's like, yeah. Why aren't we using them? I mean, it's sad, really.
Looking at the pricing and the packages, I like this. This to go back again to reverse engineering the notions, like there's a household edition, a family pack for up to 5 people living in the same household. I like this idea of like whatever it is Tinderbox is that like my son and my daughter and my wife would be using it, and I guess my dog, but just are just, it's sort of like what would we even, man, it would be intolerable because everyone would be sort of like a super nerd like me on this stuff. And we would have like lengthy relationship damaging debates about how to properly tag things. It would be very upsetting. I wonder if librarians can marry each other. I can't see that would work. Maybe if they're very calm librarians.
I should ask some librarians. Some of my best friends are librarians.
Yeah, like it just, man, like even with my wife Kim, we spend a lot of time debating simple things like how to organize photos maybe this is a little technical, but sort of like, you know, I'll let the listener figure it out, but one of us should use a password manager whereas the other one does, and there's just like basics like that
right.
Like, we debate over, and then imagine if we were both using a password manager. And then we would have like further debates about how we would organize it and tag it and like, which one do you share and not? And it's just like, oh man, debating the mind map for the weekend camping trip. That seems like it would create the need for some marriage counseling.
Yes. And I always like to go, as you know, I always like to go meta on these things because I can't really think in detail, but a lot of this, the work that you are describing, I remember listening to ATP, the podcast recently, and thinking these privileged guys, and they are privileged and they are guys, all complaining about how the computer doesn't work the way they want it to work. Why can't they just, you know, deal with it? And then I thought, well, wait a minute, there's two routes here. There's either the user of the computer. Who says computer anymore? The user of the computer does the work on your own desktop. You cope with calendar not working or whatever it is. Or you direct your attention and intent back up to the provider of the systems and say, make them better. And that seems to be, I didn't regard that as legitimate before. And now I kind of do, because I am not using a general, you know, ICS type calendar. I'm using Apple Calendar and I'm using Apple Contacts and I'm using Apple Maps, and they're great up until the point where they're not great, but that has to be their problem. I can't, you know, as you describe, I can't keep on patching and fixing stuff. I want them to do it. You know, I'm paying them money, and yeah, it's another rabbit hole, but a lot of that work in the early part of using computers felt like personal creation, you know, like HyperCard. And now it feels like patching. I don't want to get into patching the stuff I've already paid for.
Mm, yeah. Having to come up with your own directory structure for things. That's terrible.
Exactly. And and having to think about tagging and that sort of stuff. And this is definitely for another day, but looking at things like the search in Google Photos, that's a very interesting idea. But it is imposing some sort of structure, and thinking particularly of librarians, that someone, you know, some person plus a lot of machines has decided is structure to put over that information. It's good, but it's still pretty weird. And I don't think we're used to yet those kinds of self-generating systems and self-generating interfaces.
Yeah,
and it's amazing to be able to look in photos and type in, you know, egg and get, yeah, they're all eggs, apart from the ones that look just a bit like eggs. But I mean, it is amazing.
Yeah, you know, and maybe that I left that off when you're talking. There must be some name for this, but there's sort of like the first reasons you use some piece of technology, and then there's these like follow on secondary things that become cementing, I guess. Like they become you discover them later on, and you're like, oh, this is a good reason. This is why I wanted to use it, even though you didn't know about it. And I think I think you're saying I don't fully know what to do with the search. And just so, I mean, just to summarize it, I mean, if you know, it's for people who don't know, like, it's basically like natural language search over your photos. So you could search for, I'll have to test this out, but you could probably search for cars that are blue and it would show you like cars that are blue. And like, you can just search for like crazy stuff. And sometimes it doesn't work very well. And, you know, it is sort of limited by the, as they would say, corpus that you have. But it is kind of amazing. And then also, I guess the point that even I don't think about very much is, as you say, the emergent nature of it, where it'll suddenly say, here's a lot of pictures of pans. And you're like, oh, I had no ideas I took so many pictures of pans. And so it like finds these weird like clusters. Yeah. Like there's an album it makes called Things. And you can go look around there and just figure out what you like to take pictures of, I guess. Which, yeah, it is. I mean, I don't like to call any of this stuff AI or whatever, but it is sort of like really close to maybe even the conversation you would have with a librarian, where you would say, I want to go read books about blue cars. What do you have on that? And then they just sort of like could refer you to books on blue cars. And it is kind of a weird sort of whatever it is it's doing is strange, but it's kind of magical.
It is very strange. And having that album called Things feels very Google. It feels like the machine is talking to me. No humans are talking to me there. And it does make I can understand why people I've spoken to have a degree of either nervousness about it or actually reject it, because there is a feeling of, let God and let Google, and just saying, well, okay, I'm putting all my stuff up there and something, 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 emergent categories. And I have a lot of interest in it. I don't know whether I have a lot of faith in it. And I think with a lot of this stuff, it's really a question of, well, let's see how this looks in 6 to 9 months, because it has changed and it has developed so quickly that, yeah, blue cars, yeah, but blueberries, things that go with blueberries, yogurt, when do I take photos of certain things? All that information is just under the surface there. And at the moment, it feels like, particularly in Google Photos, we are being shown things simply because they occur, rather than through any additional thought about them. So, you know, you can get kind of supersets like food or plates or something like that, but there's no, it doesn't feel, I mean, this is condemning Google a bit too much, really. It doesn't feel human yet.
Yeah, for sure.
Feels, I mean, in comparison to Apple Photos, it's way, way beyond. I mean, Apple Photos feels pretty thin in comparison.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, as not that Google Photos can do this, but they just like get over the whole need to it. But like, until Apple Photos can support like multiple directories and hard drives, it's just I don't know what they're doing. It's crazy. Like, it's just it feels like, of all people, they would know that like after like 5 years, you have like a terabyte of photos. and not to mention between all of your family members, and it's just like, and so I need to solve that problem. Like, and it shouldn't include like finding 100 megabits a second like internet, and then like bringing your desktop tower there and plugging it in there for 2 weeks so it can upload all the photos. Like, that doesn't really seem viable.
Yeah, I mean, my small handful of Apple devices are probably at least 2,000 to 3,000 photos off each other.
Exactly.
So a laptop will have, yeah, and I just have to accept that. And, you know, there isn't a readout anywhere which I can refer to saying how many photos are out or how many photos are just, you know, like thumbnails. I just have to look at it and think, oh, the last photo here uploaded was like January. And I think, oh, what do I do? Just wait?
Yeah, you would think, at this stage, there would be like a photo mesh that would like look at all of your sources and give you like some unified view and be like across your 5 laptops and then your Instagram and your Flickr account, here's all of your photos. And like, maybe we just give you a thumbnail of it, but like, and then when you click on it, it'll like download it from there to wherever you are and you can do something with it. But we don't need to like centralize it everywhere. We just need to catalog. We need to curate or make a concordance of where all this stuff is, which that would be nice. But no, none of them seem to work that way that I know of.
It would be great if at least my laptop said, I haven't backed up your photos because I haven't found a strong enough internet.
Exactly. Connection.
But it doesn't say that. It just sits there.
That would be nice.
Look, all I'd have to do is pick up my laptop and walk down the stairs and everything would work again. And it won't even tell me that. It just sits there. Oh, I'm not doing anything. Don't worry. Everything's fine. Everything is not fine. You know, just tell me you want more internet and then we'll try and find you some and then you can get on with backing up the photos.
Mm.
But yes, you were saying, I feel I've diverted you entirely from the computer corner. We've made it a very big corner.
Well, that's all right. It's only the second episode. So maybe it just will be all computer corner. We'll figure out. But, you know, I'm trying to lead an integrated life. I don't want to separate all the different parts of me.
Are you? Oh, okay.
I don't know.
All right.
Maybe at the very least, a giant mind map that doesn't have any orphaned boxes on it. It's got to be at least one line that goes back.
Okay.
Is that a metaphor? Does that work?
Yes, I'm afraid it is. It's quite a goal you've set yourself there. Entirely integrated life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One bit at a time. You're going to have to put up with some of the disconnection, I think.
Yeah, I need to read in. I forget who wrote it, but whatever the first scripture is are the like 5 laws of distributed applications. That as long as you understand those, your goal to have a connected life is fine. You just have to understand the network is terrible, and it'll go out frequently.
Yeah, the network. Everything's fucked. Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
You can accept that. Yep.
All right. Well, speaking, I need to go cook some fish for my family by the license pack. And you know, our connection's
that been, sounds wonderful.
Our connection's been pretty terrible, so unfortunately, I'll make some edits, but people hear some weird lagging. But you can see the dynamics. See future communications studiers. They'll go back and study like these podcasts with a big lag time, and it'll highlight how people try to interrupt to transition and flow in their conversation in a way never before achieved. Give lots of key insights.
I strongly feel that we're never going to get better at this.
That's right. Well, it's hard to do.
We might get worse. Yeah, we might get worse, but we'll never get better. If anyone's thinking, oh, they're only like two in, they'll improve. No, we probably won't.
We should. Let me see. Where should I put this? We should put a topic list on here called "The Art and Curse of Interrupting." That is a very frequent topic in my life. So that would be a good thing to sort out. Is it ever okay to interrupt?
Yeah.
That sounds like, do you ever read that, I don't know if it's a blog or a website, do you ever read that site Reductress? It's kind of like The Onion for ladies.
Oh, yeah.
That seems like a good article they would have, is like, girlfriend, like, this woman finally got her boyfriend to stop interrupting her by killing him.
I interrupt people less. I speak to you only in a professional capacity, of course, but I definitely interrupt people less.
Yes.
It's because I've just had a kind of massive mental collapse, but it worked. I mean, it got the intended effect, really.
Yeah. Maybe I should, in my life, I should practice just going like this more. And then occasionally I'll just say, but what do you think?
Oh yeah, questions are good. Questions are very good. I'm learning so much. We haven't helped anybody apart from me personally, so I'm happy with that. But yeah, I feel I've gained.
Well, that's because you have this Tinderbox Devon Think view of the world, where it's all about your own personal library. So as long as that's improved, everything's fine.
Yes, it is.
That's right.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll wrap up, and we got a list here. We'll pick from around the top of the list last time. I mean, last time. What am I talking
Fantastic.
About? Next time.
Next time. Yes.